transcendental literature. So these are four reasons why we need someone who's spiritually more mature. Every embodied being has four defects, and that means that whatever we speak based on our own, you know, perceptions is going to be flawed in four major ways. And so we need to avail ourselves of someone whose speech is not flawed. That doesn't mean that they're not flawed. I mean, they're flesh and blood like we are. But the process of becoming a guru is a process of receiving knowledge from the infallible source, which is God. And so originally, the original guru is God. And Krishna spoke Vedic knowledge, infallible knowledge about the soul and the relationship of the soul and the spiritual world. He spoke it originally to four great personalities. Lord Brahma was one of them, the creator of the universe. Lord Shiva was another one. Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, was another one. And then the other one was the four Kumaras, great transcendental sages. And these sages, they didn't then speak, I suppose, maybe it could be like that. Having received the knowledge, they just became transparent via medias. It's like an electrical cord. It just, the current flows through it, doesn't divert it in any way. So because we have these four defects, tendency to cheat, to be illusioned, to make mistakes, and have imperfect senses, that kind of prohibits us from coming up, us from being a source of perfect knowledge. But it doesn't prohibit us from being a conduit of perfect knowledge. I may not be able to figure out what the microphone is or does by my own experiments. But if the manufacturer of the microphone explains to me what its purpose is, or if I get a manual and I read it, then I'm actually getting the knowledge isn't originating with me, it's originating with a less fallible source. And then if I tell you it's a microphone, that's perfect, right? I may be imperfect, but if I hear from the manufacturer what this is, what its purposes are, and then I tell you that, then basically there's no flaw in that process, you see. So the Lord speaks transcendental knowledge originally to Brahma, the four Kumaras, Shiva and Lakshmi, and then they pass it down as they heard it from the Lord in disciplic succession. And then more recently, Prabhupada in 1965, as the most recent representative of this age-old line of disciplic succession, he arrived in the Western countries. And because of the potency of his speech, he was speaking not in a way that we're used to. He was speaking from a different platform, an absolute platform. It was very appealing and very attractive to many, many young people. And so in the short 12 years that he was with us, between 65 and 77, he attracted about almost 5,000 young people, myself among them, to become his initiated disciples. And it wasn't a light thing to be initiated to take diksha from Srila Prabhupada. He asked that for 1 year before you take initiation, you refrain from illicit sex. That means if you're single, you're celibate. If you're married, you're faithful. Refrain from gambling. Refrain from intoxication, including coffee, tea, and cigarettes, as well as the harder stuff, obviously. And then not to eat meat. And you had to do that for 1 year. And then at initiation, you promised to do that, continue, obviously, for the rest of your lives. And then in addition to that, every candidate for initiation would agree to chant, or to work up to at least chanting 16 rounds. Lisa has the beads inside of that bag there. These are called japa beads, and there are 108 beads on each string. And one engages the sense of touch by fingering them, engages the tongue by saying the transcendental sounds, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Engages the ears in hearing it. The eyes can look at a picture or a form of the Lord, and then the nose can smell the incense or flowers. So all the senses are engaged in this way. So those are the sacrifices, you might say, or the lifestyle changes that we made in order to become known and to connect with Him in disciplic succession. And then our duty is, by purifying our consciousness through the chanting and cleaning up our diet and our lifestyle habits, then we can begin to become qualified to transmit transcendental knowledge just as he was qualified to give it to us, just as his guru was to his, and then all the way back to the original disciplic session. And then, of course, you have to study also. You have to study and apply yourself and know the scriptures. So this is the principle. The guru is not someone who is walking along and gets a flash of light. They have this system called Shaktipat. And it's supposed to be a process of initiation where the guru touches the disciple, and the disciple gets this like jolt of electricity, you know, and then they get all the knowledge that the guru had. Well, the process that we're describing is a little more conventional than that, you know. Knowledge as we experience it is a revelatory process over a period of time, right? You take a course in geology or biology, and you know you've got to go through the whole semester, attend the classes, do your homework, and then maybe you get a grasp of the subject matter. If you went to biology and said, "Teacher, I really don't have time for all this, you know, I don't want to attend the class, I don't want to, could you just touch me, you know, and then give me an A?" That would be ridiculous, you know. And yet this is seriously accepted by, you know, New Ages and people as a bona fide method of initiation. And sometimes it works. I mean, I won't deny you that there have been people who have been touched by saintly people, and they gave up all bad habits and they've changed, maybe 1 in 1,000. But most of them just go down the street and have a cigarette. That's what happens after this kind of initiation. Well, the kind of initiation we're describing, they haven't had a cigarette for at least a year. and if they want to be heirs to this disciplic succession, then they're not going to have any more the rest of their lives. So although we do have these defects, we can transcend them by connecting ourselves to a bona fide guru. Now, you've heard of the caste system in India, that only certain people can access transcendental knowledge, and only certain people can play the role of a Brahmin or an intellectual or teacher. But this verse refutes that. Kiba vipra kiba nyasi sudra kenehaya ye krishna tatvadeti se guru haya. What is the qualification for being a guru? Do you have to be born in such and such a high class Brahminical family in order to be a guru? Or if you're not born in a Brahminical family, if you're born the son of a blacksmith or the son of a farmer, then can you not be a guru? Absolutely not. It doesn't matter whether you're a learned scholar or whether you're born in a lower family or whether you're in the renowned sort of life. If someone knows the science, Kaniya is a different way of saying Krishna, then he is the perfect and bona fide spiritual master. Again, you go to college, you don't give your teacher the third degree. Well, you know, where were you born, you know, and what was your parents' income, and what are you, a Boston Brahmin or not, you know? I mean, that's not important. You want the best teacher who knows his stuff and can give you the highest level of knowledge and inspire you that. So whoever can do that is a guru. You don't have to have any Of course, now we're gonna see here shortly in 2 or 3 slides how Prabhupada, our guru, was born in a family of pure devotees. And certainly if you take birth in that atmosphere, probably your chances of imbibing and getting excited and infused with that are greater than if you're born in, you know, a family of Hell's Angels. But still, nobody is barred. Everybody is available, that if some or other one has the talent and the aptitude, they can do that. This is a little bit of a lengthy quote. In the beginning, this is going back to the beginning, you know, this is the pre-initiation days. This is just curiosity, you know, why are these people dressed like this? Why do they build this temple? What are they about? Why are they worshiping the deities? Let me go and find out. That's basically, you know, many of you are here for the first time. In the beginning, a desire or just a curiosity. This will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. Well, these people are nice people, and they always talk. Just like I said to Ben on Sunday night, you know, we just had this, I don't know, Thoreau used to say that, you know, his fellow transcendentals used to come and visit him in his cabin, and the topics were so elevated that the walls would literally throb. You know what I'm saying? And you feel that when you go to some of the 2,000-year-old South Indian temples where 50 to 100,000 people come a day and express their devotion to the deity. You feel that. You feel the walls are permeated with this kind of an atmosphere. So I said to Ben, I said, you know, we just from like, I don't know, 3 o'clock. We started at 3 o'clock, didn't we? All the way till 9 o'clock, we were talking about God, we were talking about the soul, we were talking about self-realization. I mean, how fortunate are we to be able to talk on this level and at the same time support ourselves? You know, it's not like we could talk this way and then we have to go, you know, do something else to support ourselves. That the Lord promises in the Bible and according to the Talmud, to the degree that you dovetail your words, your mind, your deed, to the degree that you show interest in my glories and my mission, I will support you. Don't worry. You know, I'm not going to just leave you out in the cold. I'm going to support you. And so we were expressing our appreciation for that on Sunday night. We just had philosophy, singing, dancing, feasting. No complaints here, you know. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. So the elements are, of course, if you're sick, there are certain things that you need to prohibit, certain foods and things you can't eat, and then there are certain medicinal things that you should eat. There's negatives and positives. So to cure ourselves from conditioned life, which means repeated birth and death and revolving in the cycle of reincarnation, we agree to give up 4 things which are antithetical to purity and spiritual advancement and peacefulness: meeting, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication. And then on the positive side, we take the medicine. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, Anechu Ushodi Maya Nashi Bada Lagi. He says, the medicine has come to cure birth, to cure death, to cure disease, to cure old age. And that is the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. Of course, we've taken this birth and we're going to die. That's everyone who's born is going to die. But those who have the names of the Lord on the tip of their tongue throughout their life are not going to take another birth. So in that sense, your conditioned life in this material world is over. So by execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment, attains steadfast in self-realization, and acquires a taste for hearing about the Absolute Person. This stage is called Ras in Sanskrit, and it's a very, very elevated stage of spiritual maturity. One who has a taste for hearing of Krishna's name, that means they can't live without hearing Krishna's name, that or any name of God. When they hear a name of God, they get goosebumps on their body. Their hair stands on end. They tremble in ecstasy, and they simply want to repeat the name over and over and over again, just like a fish in water. You know, we read about Lord Jesus Christ and various luminaries, various spiritualists that have dotted the landscape of human society, and our tendency is to think they're so extraordinary, they're so special, they're so different, you see. But what they are is healthy. They're just normally healthy. Someone like Jesus Christ or Prabhupada, gurus are just normally healthy people because, you know, a fish out of water may have a car, it may go to the gym, you know, it may have pecs and abs, it may have a pantry full of all kinds of food storage for the next 20 years, you know. And on a certain level, you might say, well, by these criteria, that's a well-adjusted, healthy, normal, wholesome fish. But you're missing an important point there, is that the natural environment of the fish is in the water. And no matter what other adjustments he may make, or amenities he may surround himself, there's something really glaringly, it's like the king has no clothes. You know, there's something wrong here. The fish is out of water. He's dying there. And you got to get, and you don't, and all these things won't substitute. All you got to do really is just get him back in the water, and he's comfortable. So this taste for hearing about the glories of the Lord, it may seem alien. I mean, I don't know what you thought. First time I walked into a Christian temple in like 1965. It's funny because how can I explain this? They are having in Australia, I met the devotees in Australia, and the first temple I went to was in 1970 in Sydney, Australia. And it was a little rented place. And we walked in, and there was incense, and the devotees were chanting. And I didn't really think it was that strange. But it's funny because in May, they're going to have the 40th anniversary of the installation of the Sydney deities. Prabhupada brought those deities from Bombay, and he installed them in May of whatever it was, 40 years ago. You see, this is a few months later. And they invite us to come because we were there. I don't think we're going to be able to come because there's too many. They're going to pay our tickets and everything, and I think we're going to pass on that. Then the second thing, they invited me to write an 1,800-word article about our experience. And I said, I'd love to, but I'm not sure that I'm going to have time for that either. So what Korma did is, my old friend, who actually wrote a book called The Great Adventure, he wrote a book about the early days in Australia, a big book. And he came here and he interviewed us for about a week. And many of our quotes are in the book. And then he also had the raw notes. So when he realized I wasn't going to come and I wasn't going to write the article, he said, they're printing a commemorative issue. So he said, I took the liberty of using your quotes and writing an article from the first person singular point of view about you and Vaibhavi and your part in the ground level Australia. So he wanted me to read it and correct it and send it back. So I just read it. And that's why I can stand here and tell you it wasn't so strange when I walked in, because I just read my quote, you know, from 10 years ago about something that happened 40 years ago, and he said that I said it didn't seem that strange when I walked in the room. So that's how I can tell you that. I don't really, but it didn't seem that strange. But it may seem strange if you're coming in for the first time. But it's not unpleasant, certainly. It's not onerous, it's not a chore, it's not painful, it's cholesterol-free, and we feed you. And so it's not that bad, you know, it's not, certainly one wouldn't necessarily have a negative reaction to it. And if one comes back, it kind of gets under your skin. You know, many times people come and visit us on Sunday, and then they come back on Thursday and they say, you know, I can't get that chant out of my head. You know, it's been 4 days. What do I have to do to get that chant out of my head? It kind of gets under your skin. And what to speak if you come to the Festival of Colors, where they do it with 25,000 people for 8 hours. It's months before you get out of here. But the taste comes about, and you realize that this is actually, although it may seem a little foreign to our normal behavior, it is actually quite natural. It is natural to glorify God. And the more we do it, the more we feel at home doing it. And the example is given of a man in India that has, Radhakrishna lived in India for, 2 years, and I've been many times back and forth. A man that has hepatitis, the eyes get red, yellow and jaundice, and stool comes out white. And the interesting symptom with that is that when you're in jaundice condition, sugar tastes like bitter. It's like, and yet sugar is the cure. Sugar is the cure. But the jaundice man will fight like anything not to have to swallow sugar. It often takes 4 people to hold him down and to force feed him sugar. Sugar cane, not white processed sugar, obviously. I hope you got that part. Anyway, sugar cane, you know, they're squeezing sugar cane down his throat. You know what I'm saying? If he's your enemy and you want a quick death, you give him white sugar while he's jaundiced. That works really good. He's gone. You know? But this is sugar cane, which is actually good for you and natural like that. And as he drinks the sugar cane, and then his body starts to restore itself, then he begins to taste sugar for what it is, which is very sweet. So there's nothing sweeter than Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram. Great saints and sages, I can give you names if you like, they have chanted this up to 23 hours a day. They have relished the pleasure, the bliss of associating with God through his holy names by chanting up to 23 hours a day and leaving 15 minutes to eat and 45 minutes to sleep in a 24-hour period. Rupa Goswami, Tunde Tandavinam Ratam Batanate Tandavala Labde, he said, Krishna, how come you only gave me like one tongue to chant your holy names? Because when I, Krishna, 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 when I take those 2 syllables, Rama, and I churn them in the courtyard of my mouth, so much nectar. And again, the example of sugar cane. Sugar cane is kind of like, it kind of looks like bamboo, but it's full of juice. So when you chew it, the juice explodes in your mouth. So Rupa Goswami says, when I chew these 2 syllables, Krishna and Rama, the nectar that's produced is indescribable. And I wished I had hundreds of mouths and hundreds of tongues, because it's just, the more you have it, the more you want. So this is natural and this is normal. So let me just go to the other slides so we get more than, you know, 2 slides done in a half an hour period. The coconut is symbolic. In India, you'll see, I think we might have talked about this last, you'll see a lot of people, they'll buy a coconut from a vendor at the entrance of the temple, and then they'll give it to the priest, and the priest will smash it. And there's sometimes they're just like smashing hundreds of coconuts. You can only hope that someone takes them and they use the milk and the meat and it doesn't all go to waste. But we are comprised of three layers like the coconut. The outer layer, the husk, is like the body, made of earth, air, fire, water, and ether. The inner layer is the mind, made of mind, intelligence, and pulse. It's a psychic body. When you dream, your gross body is lying peacefully in bed, but you're on another planet, or you're flying through the sky, or you're surrounded by snakes. I don't know what your dreams are, but anyway, sometimes I have that dream. I don't know what it means. But it's your psychic body. Snakes everywhere. Haven't had it for a number of years. It's your psychic body experiencing this, you know. And they talk about the silver cord. Remember Rob sang Lampa in the 60s radio. The mind, they say, well, how come if there's a sound or someone shakes you, you wake up right away if you're so far away? But the mind stretches. You've heard of stretching the mind. The mind stretches it. It can even go to distant planets and be having experiences. So that when something wakes you up, it just retracts and then you're right there. And then inside is the soul. So when you break the coconut, you're symbolically releasing the liquid milk, which represents the soul. You're releasing it from the interior of the coconut. One must learn to do this under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. The Bhagavad Gita itself says, try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively, and render service to him. The self-realized souls can impart knowledge to you because they've seen the truth. Love of God is not something you just learn from a teacher in a classroom. It's something that you catch. It's like infectious. I think I gave this example last week. If you have a friend, and then your friend loves a girl, and he's talking about this girl, and and then you start thinking, well, you know, boy, I'd really like to date that girl too, you know, because his affection for her is contagious. And hopefully you didn't, because he's your best friend, all right? Hopefully you were able to, you know, draw a line there. So similarly, how do you know? How do you know who's a bona fide guru? How do you know who's a spiritual master, right? How do you know? Prabhupada said, not very difficult. Not very difficult thing. How do you know if someone's working as a salesman for IBM? How do you know? Well, he's probably got IBM pens in his pocket. He might have an IBM pin. He might have an IBM monogram jacket. He might have a tie with IBM computers on it. He's probably got a briefcase that might say IBM on the side. And inside is all kind of IBM brochures and machines and things like that. And most importantly, when he talks, he's probably not going to talk about Xerox. Is that a safe bet? I'm going to talk about IBM. So how do you know a lover of God? How do you know a bona fide guru? Because in his association or her association, his only interest is God. Someone would say, well, how could you just be interested in that one thing? I mean, there's so much else. But there isn't anything in this world that's not contained in God. There's no beauty out here that doesn't originate in the form of God. There's no wealth out here that doesn't originate in the form of God. There's no knowledge out here that doesn't originate in the form. There's no hero, there's no movie star, there's no rock star, there's no singer, there's no beauty whose beauty and fame and charisma did not originate in God. This is the source from which everything comes. So far from diverting or limiting yourself, when you focus on the cause of all causes, the origin, then nothing actually escapes you. Because in life, you know, the road not traveled. Robert Frost has that famous poem, which way will I go? Because as soon as you decide to go that way, you're never going to have those experiences. And you're always going to wonder about it. If on the other hand you go that way, you'll never have those experiences. You always wonder. But if you go to the root, of everything, the source of all beauty, all wealth, all fame, all knowledge, and all renunciation, then nothing escapes you. Nothing eludes you. Because everything is contained in that. So it's kind of like a great convenience, right? Instead of trying to water each root and flower and leaf of the tree, which, you know, is not going to work anyway, You just have to do one. Instead of doing 100,000 things, you just have to do one thing. And that one thing will also bring nourishment to all the flowers, fruits, and leaves of the tree. So, but of course, we can't see God in our present state, so we approach His representative in the line of the civic succession. By the grace of the... Now, this is interesting. Families, you know, in India, there are actually families, even to the present day, that actually... I just got done saying that it's not by birth, right? You've heard... So now am I contradicting myself? Not really, because there are families that produce pure devotees generation after generation after generation. And how does that happen? The kids will always imitate their parents, right? Aram, once again, it was his birthday. I want to go to Krishna's house. I want to go to Krishna's house. Why does Aram want to go to Krishna? Because his parents like to go to Krishna's house. So he likes to do what they like to do. They take pleasure in it, and so he imitates them, and he takes pleasure in what they take pleasure. So there are families in India whose parents are lovers of God. They have the deities, they have the altar. The children will hear the bell ringing in the morning, they'll smell the incense, the songs will be there, the chants will be there, the pujas will be there, neighbors will be invited in for a little discussion, and there'll be festivals in the home. And this is how they grow up. And everyone imitates their parents, and so it's natural that some families produce pure devotees generation after generation. So Prabhupada said it's fortunate to take birth in such families. Now, I mentioned about taking birth in a family of hell's angels versus taking birth in a family of Brahmins. It's not by accident what family you take birth in, according to the Bhagavad Gita. It's not by accident. From its previous life, a soul leaves the previous body with a certain consciousness. It's just like the air carries aromas from a garbage pit, it carries pungent aromas. From a rose garden, it carries sweet aromas. So every one of us, based on the choices that we make, the foods that we eat, the people that we hang out with, the books that we read, their set of beliefs, we have a certain fragrance about us. Some of the fragrances are not very nice. Some of them are quite nice. So at the time of leaving the body, it says, just as the air carries aromas, the subtle body, that mental body I described, is a vehicle which carries the soul to a womb of parents of like disposition. Of like disposition. So if you want to have children in the future and you want to have really special kids, then you're going to get a child which is going to complement your own disposition. And that's why in India, a lot of times, in addition to trying to live a righteous, pious life and trying to create a congenial shelter for a prospective soul, in addition to doing that day by day, on the day of conception, and you can pretty much figure out the day that the lady is most likely conceived. And so they actually decide, okay, tonight we're going to try for a baby. And if you're in a, it's kind of funny, because if you're in a village in India, there's nothing secret about this, you know. We're going to try to have a baby tonight, you know. And everyone's like, yeah, Yeah, they'll be wishing you blessings and everything like that. And then what they'll do is they'll chant. The whole day they'll chant on their beats. And the neighbors will be there and they'll just try to create this wonderful, attractive spiritual atmosphere. So when the couple go in, you know, and the neighbors are probably all standing right outside the walls, you know, like, go, you know, yeah. Like that, you know. They want to attract the highest caliber level of soul into that womb. And that's a joy, you know, to be a parent. On the other hand, you just imagine the flip side, you know. You know, in the back seat of a car on a Saturday night with a liquor bottle on the floor, you know, what kind of a soul is going to come into that womb, you know, under those circumstances? Who are you attracting, you know? So for a moment's pleasure, a moment's thoughtlessness, you know, a moment when you're just overwhelmed by your own hormones, you know what I'm saying? You're going to pay for your whole life. You know, you're even going to have an unwanted child that you have to kill by abortion, or you're going to have a child that's just not going to be very gratifying to you. So Prabhupada says here, fortunately, both our spiritual master, Om Vishnupad, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami, and our humble self had the opportunity to take birth in such families by the grace of the Lord. And both of us were trained in the devotional service of the Lord from the very beginning of our lives. Later on, we met by the order of the transcendental system. So we're a little bit over here from the start of the yoga class, so I'll just wind this up. This is Prabhupada, our guru, as a very young boy on the left hand. And this is his father, a pure devotee of Krishna named Gaur Mohan Day. And then you see the altar of Radha Krishna in the back. They had the altar right in their home. And all these celebrations took place. And then you see, again, at a later age, this is Prabhupada, the mustachioed fellow with his first child on his lap. And then this is his father and mother. And this was a family, a household that was just permeated with devotion. Prabhupada grew up in that, and Prabhupada became a pure devotee. And his guru also grew up in such a household as the Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So that, I think, will suffice tonight. We'll turn everything over to Sri Hanumanji for the yoga class. And as I thought, we are going to go one more week on this topic of the guru. But thank you very much for your attention.